Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Karen Malpede has plenty to say. She is the author, director of 19 plays produced in the United States, Europe, and Australia, a body of work that focuses on critical issues of the day, resistance to war, violence, human rights, and social change. Her most recent play, Extreme Weather, spelled W-H-E-T-H-E-R, is an eco-drama about climate change. Set in upstate New York during the record hot summers of 2004 and 2012, it pits brother and sister in a bitter debate about the future of our planet. Karen and her husband, actor-producer George Bartenieff, are co-founders and co-artistic directors of Theater 3 Collaborative, which, since 1995, has been creating, developing, and producing new poetic language, character-driven plays on pressing social issues. The Collaborative features Festival of Conscious Talks and Talkbacks with experts and activists who discuss the theme of each specific production. Her plays, Prophecy, The Beekeeper's Daughter, Iraq, Speaking of War, a docudrama, and the Obie-winning I Will Bear Witness, co-edited with Bartenieff from the diaries of Victor Klemperer, have premiered at the Theater 3 Collaborative. Malpede, who has written numerous articles and essays on theater and social change, is a recipient of a McKnight National Playwrights Fellowship and an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication and Theater Arts at New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Karen, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. It's lovely to be here.
So I want to start this way. It's a long way to New York from Wichita Falls, Texas, where you were born to a Jewish mother and an Italian-American father. And I read that you described your background as alienating, and because you didn't fit into any group, that's what helped you write free-ranging drama. So talk not only about your background, but how you got into theater and wound up here.
Actually, my mother was an actress, and my grandmother was also an actress. She had come to New York as a young woman in the 20s to study theater. And then she went back to Chicago, where the family was, had lived for several generations, and married very young, and gave birth to my mother very young. And my mother also became an actress and had a radio show, actually, on which called Something for the Girls before feminism, on which she interviewed Eleanor Roosevelt, her proudest moment.
Oh, wow.
My mother's family were Roosevelt Democrats to the core. My father's family were on relief during the Depression and hardcore Republicans.
So there's a marriage, either made in hell
right,
or, well.
Right. And Wichita Falls was just a blip on the screen. My father was in the Army. And my mother was working also on the Army base as a secretary in the legal department, and he was an accountant.
Well, what did you find alienating as you grew up? Why did you feel that
I'm
you were
sure
out of place?
I'm not sure where
that quote came from,
but it doesn't,
it doesn't matter, but I'll
give you a little more background. My parents, after the war, housing was very tight, and my mother's family had grown up on the South Shore of Chicago, South Side, and my father's family in the Italian neighborhoods of Chicago, which were west, I think. But we ended up on the North Shore, and the North Shore in those days, although it's changed considerably, one of the suburbs was restricted against Jews. It was mainly, I mean, the big question was, which Presbyterian church did you go to? And the other big question was, what kind of a name is Malpede? The schools were fantastic. The Lake Shore was fantastic. Lots of the people were fantastic, but the ambiance was
Unsettling?
Narrow in that sense.
And all this obviously had quite an impact on you.
I think it was a combination of these very good schools where we were reading James Joyce and going to see Genet's The Blacks in high school on high school trips and, really being exposed to all kinds of wonderful ideas and literature. And then the jarring sort of reality of the sometime, not everybody by any means, but the experiences.
Do you think that that's where the seeds were sown growing up with this concept of yours with social change and taking on important issues?
Yes. I mean, I think that's a fair assumption. I mean, one never knows where they actually come from. But as I said, I think it's a combination of the literature, because most great literature is takes on social issues and takes on human suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I loved literature from all my life. And then the experiences of sort of seeing firsthand that not everybody was treated equally, that there was, that there were tensions, and there were tensions within the families too, and within the family. So, yeah, all of that.
So, when did you write your first play, and why? And you felt that you had something to say, obviously.
I wrote my first play when I was 29. I had already written a book that it was my master's thesis from Columbia, which was about, it was called People's Theater in America, and it was a history of people's theater from the 20s through the 30s up to the 60s. And then I was working with a wonderful theater group called the Open Theater, headed by a genius named Joseph Chaykin, who was one of my early mentors. And Joe was having a meeting in his apartment in Westbeth, sort of weekly meetings to talk about what should we do in the theater now. And I kept saying, well, the theater has to become poetic again, because the Open Theater had been mainly physical theater, the physical theater of the 60s, a very beautiful physical theater, lots of wonderful sounds and music, but limited in words and limited in character. So I was saying, well, the theater has to be poetic, it has to be character-driven. And Jean-Claude Van Attali, who was a playwright, a well-known playwright, is still alive, looked at me across the room and he said, it's a lot easier to talk about it than to do it.
And and he laid down the gauntlet.
Exactly. There were very few women playwrights known at that time. There were some. Women didn't write plays. Women's plays weren't produced. If you did write a play, Susan Glasspell wrote wonderful plays too. Many women did. But you were the only woman in that season or in that on Broadway that year or whatever. And I wrote a play called A Lament. It ended up being called A Lament for Three Women. And it was a reflection on my father had died of cancer when he was quite young. And it had been already 10 years since he had died. And that's what came out. It was the story of three women who meet in a hospital waiting room. If you've ever had anybody ill, you spend endless hours. And you get to know the other people.
These strangers become very close to you.
Exactly. So it was three women. One was a mother whose son was dying. One was a wife whose husband was dying, who had the fears my mother had, because they were young people when my father died, of being a widow, never having worked for a living, having worked but not alone. And then a daughter whose father was dying. So it was those three women, and they tell the stories of their three men and of their relationship with the three men.
Was it hard to write, or did it just flow out of you?
Everything is hard to write. Everything is hard to write, and it also flows out of you. So that's usually how it works. You struggle for a long, long time. At least I make many wrong attempts. My computer is littered with bad writing, files I shall never open again. And then all of a sudden, I like to say, I hear the voice of the play. And once I hear the voice of the play, I hear all the voices in the play, and then I can write it. But that takes a long time. And then when you're in the middle of that, you also hit dead ends, and you struggle and struggle, and you walk away, and you tear
Hence
your hair
the term,
out, and
writer's
you know,
block.
Yeah, and but that's the process. So beginnings are hard, endings are hard, middles are hard. It's all, but it's fascinating.
And when it was over, what happened?
I took it to Joe Chaykin, and he loved it, and he wanted to direct it. But it was the beginning of the feminist era, and I thought a woman should direct my first play, and so I thanked him.
Well, I didn't actually.
No, I had no idea that I would ever direct a play, and I didn't direct it. But another one of his young women he was mentoring, directed it. And then I had a residency at Cummington Community for the Arts in the summer, where I had writer's block the entire time I was there. I couldn't write a word. I was trying to write the perfect first sentence of my second play, which was an impossible task. The actors came up and we performed the play there. And there I met this extraordinary man named Ned Ryerson, whose family was very wealthy, and he was divesting himself of his personal vast fortune and giving it to artists whose work he admired. And he liked my play. And he became the patron of the first theater I ran, which was called New Cycle Theater, with a man named Burl Hash, who had come from Chelsea Theater Center, and he and I hooked up. And so with those two pieces of money, we started a theater at the far south end of Park Slope, Brooklyn, totally untrendy in those years. We paid the actors, but we did not charge admission. This was how idealistic we were. So we had the little kids from the tenement house next door, the Italian ladies in their black dresses looking like my grandma, coming to see the plays. And probably the first plays. Yeah, the first plays they'd ever seen. And sophisticated people who traveled to Brooklyn, like Dorothy Dinnerstein, the great writer and thinker, who traveled to Brooklyn to see the plays. And then we were invited from there to become the first theater company at the Arts at St. Anne's. Now it is a Brooklyn church and an arts center in Dumbo. Mm-hmm. But at that time, the arts center was in the church, and we were invited in the church to do my plays until I wrote a play about Sappho called Sappho and Aphrodite, when I was uninvited to be in the church.
Because it was about lesbianism?
Yeah. Mm. But for 4 years, we did plays at the Arts at St. Anne's.
And were you successful, I ask in quotes?
I don't know what that word
that
means.
That people came to see your plays? You were written
yes,
up?
We were written up. We were...
You earned a living?
No, I've never earned a living from my work, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, but true. I've earned a living from all the things that come because of the work I do. Teaching, grants, other, you know, opportunities, but the plays themselves, because we've always run not-for-profit theaters, no.
So what started you on this road to social issues? Was 9/11 a seminal moment for you?
9/11 was an interesting moment for me because I am trained also in trauma. And was for many years an associate of Robert J. Lifton's, who had an institute at John Jay College called the Center on Violence and Human Survival. And Lifton was the first person who wrote about the survivors of Hiroshima. He wrote a book called The Nazi Doctors, where he interviewed Nazi doctors trying to figure out what that was about. And so he has been fascinated with victims and victors, and he's one of the great MD psychiatrist thinkers field. And I was, again, a member of his institute for years, and we fought every war together. His institute took a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for a ceasefire in Gulf War I, if anyone remembers that 42-day war. And in the room as we wrote the text for this ad was Allen Ginsberg, Daniel Ellsberg,
wow,
and a number of other extraordinary people. And Daniel Ellsberg was near tears because he said, they're going to invade Baghdad and it will be an endless slaughter that will go on for years. And this will be a disaster. This will be another Vietnam. And we have to stop this war. Well, that war stopped, as you know, because they didn't invade Baghdad. Mm-hmm. But not so many years later, right? The plans were already on the table to invade Iraq and 9/11 happened. And because I was trained in trauma, I went to work for the Oral History Archive at Columbia University, and I interviewed 17 survivors and witnesses of the 9/11 attacks, long oral history interviews, three different ones over a period of 2 years. So 9/11 was a seminal moment for me. And of course, it was a seminal moment for the world. Writers are impacted as human beings, and then they translate their life experience, not autobiographically, like this happened to me,
right?
But
on a grander scale,
on a social scale, because what plays really do is, plays are about what happens between people.
Right.
The drama on stage is the drama of you said, I said, he said, she said, I want, you want, I see, I desire. And it's between people. So that becomes, in and of itself, the form is social. Social, you could say political, but it is about what happens between people at a certain moment. And I've written historical plays, and I've written plays that are contemporary, and they're all about the contemporary moment. I mean, whether you set it in history or you set it in this moment. So,
but your plays are on a grander scale. I mean, it's not so much about having a husband cheating on his wife. Your work includes directing street theater in Chicago with Bosnian refugees,
yes,
conducting dream workshops with students in Sarajevo at the National Drama Academy just after the war, directing a theater, yeah, project with Chilean torture victims. You know, this is not about the fact that my husband cheated on me.
No. The play, The Beekeeper's Daughter, which is the Bosnian play, I just wanted to talk about that because that,
sure,
leads into what some of the credits you were giving me. Thank you very much. We were in Italy. My husband, George Bartenev, and I were in Italy. We had a friend. He had a friend who owned a castle in Italy. It was in her family, a 13th century castle. And she used to invite her friends to summer in the castle. So for many years, we went every year for 2 or 3 weeks to Umbria and lived in this castle, and which was great. And in 1994, we went, and the Bosnian War was raging. And the Bosnian War in Bosnia was about 300 miles away from where we were staying in utter luxury, right?
The contrast was pretty stark.
The contrast was pretty stark. And there was a great journalist, and I've forgotten his name. I'm sorry, I can't bring it to my mind at this moment. But he had already written a series of articles in Newsday, the newspaper, about the Bosnian rape camps. And the women, the Bosnian women who were being incarcerated and systematically raped by Serbian soldiers so that they would produce Serbian babies. And by doing that, destroy the Bosnian culture and heritage. And this news was out. I was in Italy, wining and dining, but feeling literally that I could hear the guns coming through the soil. So that's when I wrote the play, The Beekeeper's Daughter, and it was about a Bosnian refugee who is taken out of Bosnia by an American human rights worker. Because of that play, I met a lot of Bosnian refugees and Croatian refugees, and they all came to the play,
mm-hmm,
and they felt their story was being told.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And from that, I was invited to go to Bosnia. We flew into Sarajevo the day after the last big shelling of the city, and there I had the great privilege of working with students and faculty at the School of the Arts who had lived through the siege and had been doing theater every day all through
despite
the siege.
Despite
everything, performing, rehearsing, keeping these rehearsal halls spotless, no plumbing, they were thin as rails, dedicated as they could be, and I had just, you know, a week of privileged time with them. They insisted on paying me, which was horrifying. But you don't turn it after a certain point. You must,
sure,
accept graciously,
right,
you know. But it was an amazing experience. And then I went to Croatia, did similar work with Croatian students.
You at some point meet and you join forces with your husband.
Yeah.
George, how did that happen? And how did you start this new theater venture?
George was the founder of Theater for the New City, which is one of the venerable, like La Mama. They were,
right,
founded at the same time. With his then-wife, Crystal, they were already estranged, but they were still running the theater.
And that was back when?
That was back in 1987. That date I'm clear about.
And you should be, damn it.
And my friend Judith Molina had come back from Europe, and her husband, Julian Beck, had died. They had worked together for years, since they were teenagers. She wanted to direct a play, and she came to a reading that I did in a bookstore of my new play, which was called Us. And it is a psychosexual drama, and she loved the play, and she wanted to direct it. And she said, I want to take it to Theater for the New City, and asked George and Crystal if they'll produce it and if they will be in it. And that's what happened. And I found George. I knew George's acting already. He's an extraordinary
actor. Yes, he has actor, quite a resume.
Extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And he was great in the play. He won an Obie for it. So that's how we met.
You worked together, but then at some point you really produced this new theater. Why?
Because George wanted to leave the daily grind of raising money for Theater for the New City. He wanted to act more. George was trained at RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. He's a classically trained actor. His parents were dancers. The movement training is in his blood. And he was spending most of his time producing other people's plays at Theater for the New City and buying the building from the city, which is now paid for. This Theater for the New City owns that building, which is great. And George and Crystal worked hard on that. And when that was almost done, he just said, I want to act more. And I'm fortunate recipient of his devotion because he loved my plays. He loved me,
so
but he also loved
directed,
my plays.
You've directed your husband in your work.
I have now many times. Mm-hmm. And in a way, we co-direct because I direct. I'm the eye out there, but he's the eye inside. And he's a brilliant actor and a brilliant mind for the theater, so we talk through every move, and mm-hmm. we yell at each other a lot. He corrects my errors, and sometimes I correct his. But we're a team, and without him, really, I mean, I know this is a show about women, and I am one, and it's so hard for women in the arts, and it's so hard for women who write poetic, political theater in the arts, and to have an actor who's also a partner, who's also a devoted husband in every way.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing. I wish it
for everyone. Sure. It's your creativity that you bring as well. So
it's been a great collaboration. It's a great thing we have had going for almost 25 years, whatever, and we're very happy and lucky.
How often do you produce new plays?
Well, we don't have our own space. Because we don't want to be, he didn't want to be doing that. I certainly don't want to be doing that. We are invited to other spaces, and often it's back to Theater for the New City. Sometimes it's to New York Theater Workshop. We've done readings elsewhere. We've done work in Europe. Other places, but we're always in Irondale Theater, John Jay Theater. We're invited to another space where we don't have to pay rent because rent is the big killer, right? We are committed,
especially in New York.
Yeah, we're committed to paying our actors and mm-hmm. everybody who works with us, but we're not committed to paying rent. So we get invited in for the 4-week run usually, and so that's where we work. And we are, George works. He's in a play now, a very successful play that was at Long Wharf and is going to Hartford Stage. So he's been in film. He stepped into Merchant of Venice on Broadway at the last minute. He did the Rabbi of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway. He works TV, film, but. So we only produce a play when I have a new play. That's what we do. It's our theater to do our aesthetic. And
That must be very liberating.
Yeah, it's sort of wonderful. it's hard to raise the money. We're in a fundraising drive, almost all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. We, like most theaters in this country, and it doesn't matter what level they're on, the money comes from the audience. People give money to the arts in this country. When it's hard economic times, as it is right now, that makes it much harder for the arts, and arts groups close, and people suffer, and everybody suffers on every level. No theater company, only the very biggest, get substantial government funding.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. We get money from the New York State Council for the Arts. We get money from the Department of Cultural Affairs. We're grateful for both. But those are grants that just say our work is good and you should give money to these people.
Yeah. So is there a new play that's in your brain?
Not in my brain because extreme weather has not yet been done. Mm-hmm. And so a new play, there's one way back there because I wrote a grant application for the next play. So there's some seed. But because extreme weather has not yet fully been staged, and I will be directing it, that is my focus. Just recently, We did a reading of it at the Cherry Lane, which was wonderful.
Extreme weather. Why did you spell it that way?
I'm so glad you spelled it out for people, too. It's obviously a play on words, but the question is whether or not we as a people, we as a world people, will be able to deal with what is truly a crisis, which is the climate crisis. And so the question is weather, you know. It's in both senses, weather and weather. I do a lot of research for my plays. I've written other plays about science. I wrote a play about genetic engineering and interviewed lots of geneticists. I've taught ecology in theater classes and conceptualized the readings. But then I was in rehearsal for a play called Prophecy when the BP oil spill happened. And I said to the cast one day, if I were not in rehearsal for this play, I would be tearing out my hair over this event. And I knew then I had to write a play that dealt with global warming. Not that the BP oil spill itself was it was an oil spill, but oil and gas,
right.
Fossil fuels. So I couldn't get to it because I had these two other plays actually in the works. We were in, and I finally, when Another Life was, while it was being done in these various productions, and there were months between the four productions, I started reading and researching the up-to-date science on global warming. And I was appalled on two counts. And that the two, you know, plays are usually two contradictory, at least, ideas that sort of gel in your head. So one was the science. The science is alarming, and the more you know about it, the more alarming it is. And the scientists are alarmed by what they're knowing and learning. And it's happening faster than they expected. The ice is melting faster. Everything is happening faster. At the same time, we're, you know, so that was going on, the science. And then the attack on the scientists for telling the truth.
Exactly.
Was, you know, and I thought this is the story.
Well, you've got a lot to say, and here's hoping there'll be plenty of people to watch it, listen to it, and come away charged up over it.
Yeah,
you know?
That's been our experience in the two readings. We've had two big readings.
That's great.
One of them, James Hansen spoke after it, he's our foremost climate scientist. And we had 150 people in the audience, and then the Cherry Lane also had 100 people.
Wonderful.
And Jennifer Francis, who's a magnificent Arctic ice scientist, spoke after that. And what we found is that audiences are hungry. They're hungry to see their own concerns reflected and
on the
in
stage.
A play.
Yeah.
And they love it. They laugh, they gasp, they cheer, they stay to talk to the scientists, they want to learn more. So, yeah, we hope that a lot of people will come and see it.
Well, on that note, we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Thank
for sure.
You.
It was a real pleasure
Thank
to
you.
Meet you, Karen,
Thank
and lots
you.
Of continued success.
Thank you so much.
Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at the 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.